Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley. I'm here with my co-hosts Tom Coffeen and Scott Hogue, and today we're going to talk about IPv6 and the USG v6 testing program. We're joined by Tim Winters with the University of New Hampshire, or UNH, and we're going to talk about his work around v6, how this whole program got started, sort of why it exists, and all the other good little details. So Tim, welcome to the IPv6 Buzz, and why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe a little bit of background, and why IPv6 is even of interest to you.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. So for me personally, IPv6 has been a kind of a quest. So I started as an undergraduate student at the University of New Hampshire, and I started in multicast routing, but then we were doing an event with the Department of Defense called Moon V6. Several people might remember that who are listening to the podcast, or even I think some of you guys. We did the Moon V6, and they asked me to come over and help them actually set up the network, because I had experience in routing. So I helped them set it up, and then I kind of stayed there in V6. And I'll be completely honest, at the time, I thought it was entirely academic and that I would never, ever see this deployed onto a real network. So we did that, we set it up, and then obviously since then I've been working on V6 on a personal level. And you know, I've really enjoyed working with it as part of being part of the UNH IOL. You know, the IOL, for those who don't know, is a lab that has roughly 150 employees. About 100 of them are undergraduate students. So most of our testing and work that we do is working with undergraduate students. And I'm sure as we talk today, I can give more information about how we do that. In particular, undergraduate students working on V6. Like I said, I was one of those. And then I now do work on lots of different things, all the way from SDN to IPv6. But my heart will always be with IPv6. And,
right. One of our brethren. Staying in there.
That's right. So Tim, how many years do you think you've been, you know, from when you very first thought, what is this thing IPv6, till now? Like, how many years have you been working on it?
I think the first time was 2003. So 15 years now.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, 15.
That's cool.
Are we comparing belt lengths here?
Yeah. Yeah.
No. I'm a latecomer at 2008. So, and if I recall, Scott, you're pretty early days, right?
Yeah, I passed my CCIE in 1999, and I was like, you know, I just want to learn something for fun. Mm-hmm. Not that I have to pass a test, and I want to learn about this thing, the next version of IP.
Yeah, one of the first things I tested was an old deck that they had put V6 on from HP. It was like the super old PC at the time, and I was like just blown away by what this was, and they were actually trying to put V6 on it. So,
did it work?
Yeah, it worked. They were one of the honest to God first implementations. HP UX, if you look at like the original V6 mm-hmm. implementation report from the 90s, we did testing, and HP UX was one of the actual systems that supported it early. And that's because of Jim Bound, obviously.
Right.
He was pushing that stuff.
That's amazing. Well, I think I was 2004, because I started testing for Microsoft on their networking stack in 2004 for the rewrite for Vista. So with Dave Thale and the rest of the team, I started doing that. So it was right around that time frame.
Yeah. So you say testing, Ed. So Tim, why would someone want to test IPv6? What is there to test?
So, you know, the testing that we do traditionally at the lab, there's lots of different testing you need to do for IPv6 first. But the testing that this program, the USGov test program, and a lot of the testing that we do is around the actual V6 stack. So one of the changes when we went to V6 was it's a brand new stack. It's not backwards compatible with the V4 one. So a lot of the testing we do involves, I'll call it base, you know, when you see the IPv6 packet, you don't blow up. We cover all the corner cases for that. We cover all the must and should in the base RFCs for IPv6. We also test things like DHCP, IPsec, IPv2. All of these were in the original profile, and the new profile that's coming out that was just announced. That one, you know, we've had updates since that program was created. The reason you want to test all of these things is so that when you buy something or get something, it can go on your network and it will get IPv6 addresses. Lately, more interesting testing-wise, we've had a lot more people trying to test IPv6 only applications. So one of the biggest changes we've had since I've started all those years ago was before everyone just kind of assumed it would always be dual stack. I think now we're finally getting networks that are IPv6 only. And because of that, that obviously changes the things, how we go about testing, what we need to test. We're doing things now such as like making sure when you install something, you get maintenance packs that it works on a V6 only network, because a lot of users who try to deploy say, great, it can be addressed just fine, but you can only do updates over IPv4 for this equipment, and that's not useful to us. So those are the kind of things we're starting to work on testing now. Obviously, we're still doing the stack testing. You know, I'm at the IETF this week. There's always updates that are happening. People are finding some really creative things to do with things like extension headers. Mm-hmm. I think there'll always be tweaks to the V6 stack, but I think a lot of the testing now is kind of moving up and on to the more interesting things now. After all these years of saying that V6, you really need to test it, I think now finally, and the V4 address is running out, have kind of led to that.
Yeah, you're like the underwriters laboratories of IPv6, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we've been doing it so long now. I mean, we work with lots of different groups. We work with the U.S. government. We work with the Department of Defense. We work with the IPv6 Ready logo. We kind of lead that organization. So between all of those, we've been testing this a long time now.
So, Tim, how do you decide what makes it into a particular interoperability case? Because you bring up an interesting point. I mean, if we're finally to the point where we can assume sort of base level functionality and folks are trying to do some more interesting things, you know, where does that line fall for you guys in terms of deciding what's essential to test for?
Yeah, one of the things we started to do, you know, for the there's a lot of networking protocols that it's actually interoperability. What you do is you break down the use cases first, and then you kind of go over the use cases and then do interoperability with different devices. As we start to go up the stack, the new profile talks about services and applications. So one thing we're doing is we're setting up, you know, I would call them pretty basic networks. We're not trying to get too crazy. And in particular, these are V6 only, so we don't have to deal with transition mechanisms. We're not doing a ton with tunneling. We're doing a little bit because of the fragmentation issues. But what we try to do is set up a network, and then we have the application vendors come in and tell us, these are the features that we know use a networking stack, and we try to make sure that they work. So it's very user-driven when you go up, as you go up the stack. There's less, you know, we're looking at these in particular items in a V6 stack. That's kind of been standard for us. Now we're starting to get into set up a V6 only network and see what things might happen to us that we weren't ready for, thought might be issues.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thanks. So where would we be without the USG V6 testing and without UNH IOL? Where would IPv6 deployment be today if your core mission did not exist and you guys didn't do it at the high level that you do it at?
So I'll answer the UNH part first. For us, you know, one of the biggest things we do, as I mentioned, is undergraduate students. We have a lot of students who get access to V6, learn it, and then go get jobs. They graduate, they move on, and they go out. So one of the big things we've been doing is we've put out, you know, right now we have 30 students working in the IPv6 group alone. And when I started, there was only two of us, but now there's 30 a year. And they all go out and, you know, these are students who are educated in V6 and they know it, which is a really good thing, right? So that's one of the bigger things we do. Some companies actually use us more for access to our students than they do for our testing reports.
Yeah, there could be listeners on this podcast thinking that they're large enterprises who have a need to deploy IPv6. And they're like, how can I find IPv6? Staff, qualified staff, you're their source.
Yeah, and to be completely honest, all of my graduating students had jobs by March this year, graduating in May, and that's kind of rare. As you know, depending on, it's kind of interesting. Almost it doesn't matter what's going out in the job market there; they're so sought after because they have this type of knowledge. And you know, it's also weirdly enough become more competitive to work at the lab. You know, it's not a course credit. We treat it as almost like an internship. They have to interview. Last year, we got 100 applications, and we only hired 30 students. So it's very competitive to get into the lab because we can't have a gazillion students working there. So we have to sort of work that out. So that's the first part of it. I think that's important, contributing to the moving V6 and deploying it, putting people out into the industry. For the US Gov profile part of the question, I think that profile, when it was written, was kind of important, it was really important. I know people point to the US Gov deployment stats and they're not perfect and they miss some of their deadlines, but it was a really big piece of, you know, thing to say, the government's going to buy V6 things. They don't want to be buying, because that program is really about profiling what a device should do so that suppliers and buyers could be talking the same language. And that program was the first one that really said, like, you know, and then they put it into their actual requirements. You know, when we buy things, we want to make sure that V6 is in them. That doesn't mean they're turning it on every one of their networks. That's a process, as we all know. But it does mean that when they go to turn it on, they're going to be assured that the things support it that they've bought recently. So I think that profile was really pushed people. I think now I'm hearing a lot more large user groups, whether it's governments or data centers or enterprises less so. They still seem to be slowly moving along. But we've heard a lot from the data center spot, service providers. We do a lot of testing for home gateways now. That's been a real popular the last 5 years. So we've seen movements in those areas. Obviously, mobile does really well when it comes to V6 deployment. They don't have a lot of the legacy hangups that other technologies have. I think the US government profile really helped give people an idea so that everyone was talking the same language. I also thought it was a really big moment because they chose not to make their own testing program, and they used industry available ones like the V6 Ready logo and used the same test cases so that vendors, you know, they didn't confuse the market even more, which would have, at the time when they did it 10 years ago, the first profile, would have been really bad because people were already hesitant. You know, do I really want to do V6? I'm not hearing a ton about it. And, you know, I definitely don't want to pay for testing, and I definitely don't want to go to 5 different testing programs. The US government just working with Ready Logo kind of made all the other people in the world go, okay, that's the way we should test V6. Everyone tests it the same way. And I think that's really important for that. And also just that they are talking about it, pushing it to the agencies. I know sometimes the US government gets a bad rap when it comes to technology. I think in this case, they were actually kind of, they've done a really nice job of staying on top of it and kind of continuing to push.
Yeah, because, you know, quite a few federal organizations have IPv6 deployed, at least at their internet perimeter and to their web-facing apps. You know, if you look at the Fortune 500, it's pretty bleak. You know, and I think those large enterprises could leverage, you know, the groundwork you've laid, you know, to help them on their trajectory of getting V6 deployed.
Yeah, that's kind of the new version of the profile. One of the things we did with the profile, the last one was one document. We broke it into two documents, and one of them is a NIST profile that's really technical and less governmental. And the reason for that is so that other user groups won't be scared to pick it up. You know, the US government thing kind of made people nervous. It had words in there about, you know, how the testing program runs, accredited labs. We broke the technical stuff out so that when someone says, hey, I want IPsec, they know what RFCs it means, what the test cases cover, all of that stuff.
Now, has there been a motion or move now that they're reevaluating and realizing that probably V6 only is the way things are going to move forward? Has there been more discussion about saying, hey, we should have a unique set of testing criteria that really matches to those use cases? Because you're seeing it from the mobile operators and the data center folks, but yeah. You know, the rest of the community is sort of like, hey, you know, we're lucky if we can get dual stack deployed.
Right. And so that's sort of where we're at right now. We're seeing the interesting test cases. A lot of them come out of the data center, and, you know, mobile's kind of doing their own thing. They always have had their own secret sauce. So I don't personally see a lot in that space from what test cases they're doing. We've definitely seen some of those. We see a lot on the service provider side because they have to interact with a lot of different vendors. So we see a lot of their use cases. You know, for the new profile, one of the things that's in there is transition mechanisms, but they're reversed. It's the reverse transition mechanisms. You know, 10 years ago, it was making V4, making V6 work over IPv4, because we thought, okay, you know, there's going to be islands of V6 that need to talk over V4 networks. This profile, and this is what's, you know, the changes, is the other way around, saying, look, we've heard, you know, there's mobile deployments that are V6 only till you get to the actual phone. And then they're doing a DNS query to show the legacy apps working over V4. We've got all these transition mechanisms now that are actually making V4 work over V6.
Yeah, it's V4 as a service.
Yeah. So, right. And that's really interesting. And so we started to get into that space. And recently, some service providers I talked to this week are actually legitimately talking about doing V6 to the only to the home in a lot of scenarios because, you know, if you've ever done this, you're essentially running two networks when you're running V4 and V6. And if you think you can get away with V6 only and then do some sort of transition mechanism that you can then later remove, that's a big win. So, you know, I've started to talk to some wireline people that are thinking the same way that mobile, because mobile had such success that they're legitimately looking at that. So that's one of the things, you know, that I think we're going to see a lot more with. I think V6 only is going to happen a lot faster than people think. Part of it, I think there'll be a scary, you know, V4, someone left a V4 thing open in the back stories, and then people will just start to shut them down a lot faster due to this, trying to plug two holes at the same time.
Yeah, I had an interesting discussion with someone up at Microsoft recently, because one of the asks actually that's coming through the team is like, should any translation service, like they just recently turned off all the tunneling protocols within Windows in the new update. Mm-hmm. So Windows itself is just basically it's V6 and V4 are turned on, but there's no transition services or translation components or tunneling services that are turned on anymore.
Yep.
And so with that was a big change, right? Because before we were dealing with, you know, Teredo. Yeah.
Yep.
And we're dealing with Isotap, and we're dealing with, you know, some 6 to 4, and you're like, what do we do with this stuff? And it was really in there for this transition time period, and we really think we're beyond that. And that's where Microsoft felt they were beyond it too. But with the current configuration of what mobile providers have, that doesn't necessarily exist in the operating systems today, right? Well, so some of the tools they're using aren't necessarily a one-for-one match, and in you know, what's available in iOS and Android isn't necessarily available for Mac or for Mac OS X or for right. Windows or for Linux. So is that stuff that you guys are sort of looking at and saying like, hey, we should give some guidance about where this stuff should move to make these?
Yeah, if you read
better?
Right. Yeah, if you read the profile, we've definitely put some words around this where, you know, some people are looking at some of those techniques, you know, DNS 6.4 or NAT 6.4. They're not actually in the profile per se. It's one of the things that we talk about as like, you might want to look at this, you know, XLAT is in the profile, which is the technology that does the flipping on a mobile phone. And we put that in there in particular because I think there might be some people who find, hey, that was a useful way to do this. You know, having a legacy V4 sitting on the phone, you know, we might want to do that on a CPE, or I think the other popular case in the future might be an IoT device that mm-hmm. can fit some of those small things. So I think both of those are interesting use cases. So when you're writing a profile like this, they don't get updated all the time. So you got to kind of give people a little bit of leeway. You know, there's obviously the base stuff where we say you have to do these things, but then there's other things where you're just sort of saying, hey, if you want XLAT, if you're a provider and you really want that on your IoT devices, this is the way for you to say, I need this, and tell your suppliers so that then they can go and build it. Because one of the complaints we get, obviously we work with lots of manufacturers who build all kinds of things from virtual routers to rail routers to switches to printers to whatever, is they sometimes want to know, like, give us direction. What things do we need to put into this box? And this is where something like this profile is really helpful to tell those guys, this is what customers are looking for. So,
right. And it's an interesting discussion also with all the software manufacturers, right? It's like, hey, they're not going to change something unless they get customer requests. So like Microsoft, until Microsoft gets a request to get 464 XLAT built into Windows 10, for instance, right?
Yep.
They're going to be like, well, we've got, I know the code's in there technically, right? Because they've got it enabled for when they've got a tablet device that's connected to, you know, T-Mobile, for instance, they've got to be able to support that.
Right.
But it's not necessarily on for the general operating system on the wireless network.
Correct. Right. And you know, that's where it'll be interesting to see what happens with all of that stuff. As people come up with, you know, interesting deployments, I think some of that stuff might gain more traction, in particular as you run into more V6 only networks.
Yeah. And I was sort of curious, you know, dovetailing off of that, sort of curious, like when you have different profiles for interfaces, like I'm assuming you guys go through a testing program that says like, hey, you know, well, we see that this thing has, you know, some sort of, you know, 4G interface. It's also got a wireless interface and it's got a wired interface. And do you guys look at each one of those and say like, these are the composition of those interfaces. These are expected services that should be able to run off of them, because clearly a 4G service, you would expect to see 464 XLAT capabilities for a V6 only network, but you may or may not expect to see those on the wired or wireless. And how do you work out like how that works? Because that's clearly not a profile thing. That's more of a operational, you know, what's supported feature-wise on the platform.
Right. Sometimes it's a conversation with the companies. And to be completely honest, a lot of times we're trying to help them.
Ah, okay.
There's definitely some guidance in some test cases where, you know, as mentioned, the IOL has been doing this a long time. So a lot of manufacturers, especially people newer to the space, will come in and ask us, like, what are people typically doing? Now, obviously, we have NDAs, but we have no trouble saying, you know, 9 out of 10 implementations did this.
Right,
support these features, and this seems to be the way that people are going with those types of things. You know, a lot of the testing we do, you know, also another thing is we also get a lot of devices that have management and data planes that are very, very different nowadays. And so we also run into a lot of issues there as well, explaining to them, like, these are the things you need to do on the data plane, and this is what you need to do on the control plane, right? It's it's a little bit simpler, you know. As we get into SDN, that's one of the things that has made V6 a little bit more interesting with those two things, is trying to break them up. And we have to work with those individual companies to try to find out, you know, it's less so, we haven't seen a whole lot of difference on the wireless and wired side. There have been some new neighbor discovery updates that have pushing power saving, and they're in the profile, and we talk about them saying, hey, you might want to look into these technologies because it's going to help your battery life. It's going to keep your battery life longer. There's also things in there like IoT, like 6LoWPAN, which is clearly designed for low-powered networks. But we also put in some stuff about, hey, if you have a wireless-only device, you might want to think about these are the types of things you need to go think about requiring from your customers.
Oh, that's cool. And I think the other part of it is that there's a sort of separation of duties that you guys are doing or servicing for the community, which is one part is the pure testing. But it sounds like there's a little bit of advisory role, and then there's also some compliance stuff that goes on there, right? So the testing can include compliance in order to meet a standard. But you can also say like, hey, we're testing you, but you're not meeting the sort of industry sets of features that are really important that your competitors are either doing or that the market is demanding in the current configuration. So there's almost two sides to what you're providing there, right?
Yeah, we absolutely are. And then one of the things we really pushed with this update in the profile is agencies were much more ready to have a conversation about what they wanted. So
that's maturity, right? That's in terms of saying like, hey, they've actually worked with V6 now enough to be able to know what they need to know, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that's going to show up is we sort of created these things called CSS or capability strings, which allows agencies to kind of label things that they want. So agencies are working. Some of them obviously are really on top of this, creating their things that they want to buy. So, you know, this is our server, this is our desktop. And that's been really helpful when you're advising people, right? You know, all the thing we'll do, we do a lot of iterative testing from the sense of, I tell most customers, come in, get your V6 stack. And then we start to talk about, okay, where are you deploying this? Do you need DHCP? Do you need IPsec? Do you need to do, are you a router? Do you need to do netconf? You know, do you want to do, what things, where are you thinking this thing's going to go? And then we definitely try to help them figure out, you know, if you don't have these components, you should test them. Here's what we can do for you. And some of it is definitely around the compliance, but some of it is just helping them understand that this is different than V4. You know, the very common one we get still to this day is people, you know, implementing V6 and then asking me, well, there's no default gateway in the DHCP messages. Right. And I'm thinking like, oh, this is totally a V4 engineer who implemented this and is waiting for the V4 to come in through DHCP. And so it's stuff like that that we're often doing too. You know, a lot of these people are still, you know, also we get a lot of companies now, and in particular with SDN and IoT space, that, you know, it's a pool sensor. They're not networking guys, but suddenly they have to know IP. They didn't have to learn IP before. Mm-hmm. Now they have to know it. And so that's the other place that we're definitely consulting them, right? I mean, obviously there's the grizzled operating system and core routing vendors. They know what they're doing. They don't need our help. There's a whole different set of people who are new to putting IP on something. And that is where we do spend a lot of our time trying to help them.
Like the common one, like, oh, the next hop in my routing table is a link local. How can that be?
How can that be? Yeah. Yep. Yep. We do. We definitely do a lot. We had one unnamed customer who came in and told us they could only put one address, just like on their V4. They could only put one address, V6 address on their interfaces. Mm-hmm. And they said I had to choose between link local and global, but the choice was mine. So I sat down with them and I got them on the phone and I explained to them like, this is not how this works in V6. Like, again, this is clearly a V4 engineer that was like, well, we have one address per logical interface, it's fine. And I'm like, that's not gonna work for you guys.
Well, then I choose ULA.
Yeah.
If I have to choose one and only one.
Tim, I was going to ask you, for all your years of doing this, what are some of the most ridiculous scenarios you've encountered? I think we've just you've just checked one off the list there.
Checked one off the list. Yeah, that one. You know, we get all kinds of creative stuff. And what's funny is some of them, I swear, you know, we deal with the problem and we explain it to everybody, and it goes away, and then all of a sudden it comes back up again. Like this, you know, the default routes are always one. We have a lot of issues with fragmentation. Mm-hmm. Fragmentation's really bad. It's a problem.
Because V4 coddled the applications, you know, V6 is a little more strict.
Yep. Well, and also, you know, from the perspective of it has to be done at the end node. So, you know, mm-hmm. we'll get a home gateway that will reassemble the packets, which is, you know, a massive no-no. So, we get that kind of stuff where it's like, I have to sit again. We just explain like, no, you can't just take the packet and put it back together. It doesn't...
I know you're only trying. I know you're only trying to be helpful, but
right. Yeah. Right. So it's that kind of stuff that we're trying to work with people, trying to get rid of the, and some of it, you know, a lot less now is around the fear stuff. It's definitely, you know, it's people just not, they're not fighting it as much as they used to, but it's, they're just ignorant, not in the bad sense of the word. They just didn't understand. Once you explain it to them, they're like, oh yeah, we have to fix this. This is a real problem.
I was sort of curious. I mean, because the next phase is like how far off we are in terms of where things are adoption-wise, standard-wise, right? Mm-hmm. RFC 6106, really ubiquitous across operating system support, but RFC 8106, not so much, right? So there's like these weird like midline points where something gets adopted from an RFC standpoint and they're like, we really need that as like 8106, but really, you know, 6106 was what made it in there. For those that don't know what these particular RFCs are, this is all about how do you get DNS information from a router advertisement down into a host operating system so you can actually do something useful, because if you don't have a DNS server, it's very difficult to look up any sort of name information. So there's some different options that are actually available out there. Is that something that you guys sort of track over time and across platforms and appliances? Is that the sort of stuff that you know, the interoperability lab is actually sort of keeping track of and doing interesting work around? I'm sure there's others like, you know, RFC 3484 versus 6724 and a handful of others that are sort of those really linchpin differences between the changes of V6 over the last, you know, few years.
Yeah, we've definitely done some studies or white papers where we say, you know, we're seeing this being implemented, whatever it might be. In this case, the DNS option, one of the things in the new profile is it's required for all base V6 nodes. So I actually think you're going to see that change. You know, this is where the profile, I think, is going to influence for the good and tell, you know, routers and hosts that they should be processing those DNS options in RAs.
Right, because for a long time, not, this was a bit of a fight.
Oh yeah, this was a real fight.
and it has some IoT history, I guess, that goes along with it. But I mean, for a long time, there was basically, I would argue that actually the operators ended up getting treated poorly in this. There were manufacturers that were trying to determine which way things need to go. Everything had to go through DHCP V6, and you need to get an option scope in order to be able to get DNS information, or you just want a pure Slack way. But there wasn't any way to get, you know, any sort of DNS information. And so it was like, we had to sort of sort this out. And finally, I think we got a little bit of a tiebreaker that came through because Microsoft decided, hey, we'll support more than just DHCP V6 in terms of, you know, being able to get this information. We will adopt RFC 6106 to be able to get that from Slack messages to make life easier for more people. But there's still a problem with Android in terms of not being able to do this on the DHCP V6 side, right?
And I get the impression that there's no chance for that ever changing, right? So I think people, you know, this is one thing for network operators, you know, we talk to them, we kind of warn them up front that if you're going to have lots of Android deployed, you can't just depend on DHCP V6.
Right.
For your network deployment, there's going to be problems. We also do testing a lot in the consumer space or home space after we did some home gateway work. And that was one of the, you know, real struggles we had was, you know, basically all the home gateways have to support all of these because they just don't know what they're going to encounter in an OS, whether it was Windows. Now it's getting better, and I think this problem is going to get better. But for a while there, you know, all the home gateways had to do DHCP, stateless or stateful, one of the two, and they had to also do the Slack option.
Right.
Because they had no idea what was going to be on their network.
Well, this is
support at all.
And it's incredibly painful from an operational standpoint. Like, we talk a lot about enterprise IPv6 adoption and just trying to really move the needle on enterprise adoption. And this is always a painful conversation to go into those environments and to say, look, you know, there's so much that's really advanced in V6 where, you know, we're at the point now where you can really turn it on with confidence and whatever operational model you're using today, you know, IT-wise, you can continue to use that model going forward. And then there's a big asterisk. Oh, well, except for Android, of course, which doesn't support DHCP V6. And so it will be relegated to V4, or you're going to have to run a parallel infrastructure.
Yep, it's well, that's one of the things. But, you know, we're getting closer and closer. It's one of the things we're trying to do is help, you know, sort of coalesce some of this stuff. Like I said, we put the DNS option in this profile to kind of say, look, this way people can get by on a Slack only network. Because at this point, you know, it's become very clear that not everybody, I mean, we have lots of implementations that don't put Slack. DHCP on the box at all. Linux kernel doesn't have it by default, so they have to go install a user package, which I think really actually impacts DHCP v6's usage from the client side. I think that a lot of people grab, you know, vanilla Linux kernels for whatever embedded system they're using and don't even realize they don't have DHCP v6 until it's way too late in the process. So then they end up using Slack, which works, you know, gets them most of the way where they want to go. So I think we're going to continue to see that kind of stuff as we go forward in the, and, you know, I don't think the next profile will be 10 years. I think this has really started to speed up to the point where they're going to have to put out them more often, but I think they should be smaller updates where it makes sense to add things. I don't think we'll be changing the base stuff. You know, the IPv6 went to an internet standard, which says, you know, we're good. So I think that kind of helps. And I think we'll do small updates for extra things outside of the base stuff as we go forward.
I think with the IoT side, right, with 6LoWPAN, 6LoWPAN has a whole set of behavior that just, you know, if you're v6 confident, you can recognize what's going on. But at the same time, you're like, hey, that doesn't look at all like what I'm used to seeing on a network in terms of how it runs. But it's designed very explicitly to allow, you know, that low power sort of performance and for very consistent behavior out of those devices based off of how the spec is written. And I think it's interesting when you're going to start seeing these IoT plays that are coming in and industrial lighting systems, everything else, and they start to adopt 6LoWPAN, how that's going to even change what happens within a network and how your profile has to be written to accommodate those sorts of need requirements versus just pure enterprise, you know, desktops, you know, mobile phones and tablets, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that's in, you know, 6LoWPAN is in this profile, even the ND stuff, which is sort of interesting. You know, it's an ongoing, that is definitely in its younger stages. I think that's going to go through some revs. There's been a couple of deployments. I think a lot of people have been taking, from what I understand, a lot of the IoT deployments, I don't want to call them proprietary, but they're one vendors at the moment. I think where you're really going to see 6LoWPAN down the road is when people go to buy second and third things to stick on those low powered networks that are all going to need to talk, you know, some version of v6. I think 6LoWPAN has a lot of great stuff, obviously with the compression and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to run into classical same thing that v6 ran into, deployment issues that people are going to have to document and say like, oh, we were really close, but these are the things. It's young. I think it's got some really interesting stuff. We put it in this profile, so if someone does want to turn that stuff on, that they can at least be talking like, hey, I know this thing has a full 6LoWPAN ND stack and does all the right stuff for registering and all of that stuff. So, and yes, it looks very different, though. It's funny. It's one of the things when my students, when I show them 6LoWPAN, there's definitely like a long head scratch. And it also...
You can talk a little bit about that because I think it's fascinating that we just think of it as V6.
Yeah.
But the reality is that it's actually something a little bit different.
Well, yeah. And the hardest thing for them, honestly, when I first teach it to a student is that what they look at isn't the full packet if they're actually looking at the hex dump because it's compressed.
Right.
Right. So like when you're doing like IPsec with encryption, it's very easy to explain to someone. You can't actually see these bits. You have to have the super secret key and then you can see what they really are. Right. But when you talk about something like 6LoWPAN and the compressed header, it's like, well, it looks kind of right, but it's like, it's not really right. So just looking at the
standards, it's right.
And so that's the other problem they have is like, they can't use the normal and it takes them a minute to think about that. And then you get into if they've been taught classic V6, you know, they're used to packets going a certain way and it's in particular ND. And it's just a whole different thing because it registers with the router and they have to learn all of that. So it's been, you know, this is the stuff I like. Actually, lately, what we've been doing a lot of the spaces is we used to always teach V6 and then kind of have them branch out. One of the things we've been playing with teaching the students now is actually having them work on other technologies first. So, you know, I used to always say my best hires were people who didn't understand V4, and then I would just teach them V6 because having to break the V4 stuff was actually really, really hard. Harder than you think. So when you're hiring people who are 18, they're like, oh yeah, I know what a V4 is sort of. And I'm like, great, you can go work in V6. But if they were like, oh, I've created all these subnets, I know routing, I was like, you're in the wrong. You can't be doing V6.
You're screwed.
Yeah. Yes. It's really hard.
Go back to your /29.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of that too when we do that stuff.
Oh, that's actually relatively amusing. How horrible is it that you're 18-year-old and you took the time to learn V4 and you're like, I'm sorry,
your career's over.
You're already tainted.
You're out of date. I can't help you.
No, that's horrible. That should not be happening. Anyway, given all the work over the many, many years that you've been doing this, I mean, it's quite clear that you probably have some pretty good, you know, even just blocking and tackling road advice of sort of like, hey, you know, this is a path of the journey that you should go through. And is there anything you wanted to share with the listeners around like, hey, this is how you should get started. These are the things that, you know, these are the landmines to avoid, or this is the stuff that you feel like any quick advice for that?
Yeah, it's kind of hard, right? I give different advice depending on the audience, right? If it's network operators or home, you know, obviously home users, I tell them, you know, don't worry about this. You should be fine if everything goes right, right? So I tell the general, like the story I give is my dad. I often say, I think of my father when it comes to making stuff work on a V6 network. I'm always, you know, thinking if he can make it work or doesn't realize it's happening, then we've done our job. So that's sort of my goal. Like he got V6 at his house. It came through his service provider and he didn't know he had it. And I came home and it was there. And I was like, this is magical. Right. And that's the kind of stuff I would love to see, you know, for that kind of stuff is like, hey, you know, home users should notice this, you know, enterprises is a very different story. What I tell them is, you know, advice or landmines is you need to start on this now. It's going to cause you a whole lot of pain down the road. I think that stuff's going to get, you know, more content is going to show up V6 only, and you're going to have something that you need to do for your job. I think V6, people who don't get on board soon, it's going to be a competitive advantage for those who do have it going. So I think that, you know, all of that factors into, you know, landmines to avoid. I tell everyone, you know, start thinking about it and rolling it out. Don't do a flag day is one of my pieces of advice. Do not decide that you're going to turn on V6 everywhere once at a time. Do it slowly, roll it out, and work out your issues as you go along for someone who's trying to deploy it. Obviously, as working at an interop lab, I would tell you, make sure that you test it. Do not just deploy without testing it in some sort of environment. You know, not even with us. I mean, obviously, we do the testing and we give out all these ready logos and these USGov S docs. I tell everybody, you know, there's lots of things with deployments. You should do a small trial before you go and think that this is good. Don't just take our report, depending on what you're doing. Our report definitely says if you turn it on and put it on a V6 network, it'll get an address, but you might have different models for deploying it. And that's one of the things, you know, I would tell everyone to look out for.
Good advice.
Yeah, because I mean, enterprises, they, you know, have devices at their internet perimeter that provide security functionality. And while those devices work fine for IPv4, they may not have full parity. Those products don't have full parity of everything they do for IPv6. And if they're going to then start to turn on IPv6 and they need to rely on those security functions for compliance, they wouldn't want to turn on IPv6 if their vendor lacked, you know, functional parity. So they have to be very careful. And some vendors aren't very clear about our product has these 16 things and 9 are dual, but these 6 are going to be these caveats because we have it for V4, but don't have it for V6. Vendors don't document that well for customers to line up and say, well, okay, I'll go ahead and deploy IPv6 and I'll have some compensating controls to cover these other six items, or these don't apply to me because I didn't turn on those 6 features for V4. So it doesn't affect me. You know, what would be your advice to some enterprises that are trying to do that lineup of what do I have that does V4? What functions does it do for V6 and line that up?
Right. One of the things, you know, this was one of the issues a while ago. I think this has gotten a lot better with the security devices. Obviously, it's not perfect. We're running into the same issues actually with applications too, right? The application will tell you, oh yeah, our cloud service works great. All of our features work on both. And then lo and behold, something needs a V4 connection, right? They have a, you know, a requirement or some server that's V4 only that cripples the app in some way, which is the same thing for the security guys, right? They try to move over stuff as fast as possible. I do think this has gotten better recently. A lot of the stuff we've seen at the lab, we do, part of the USGov profile is for testing NPDs, network protection devices. And in this case, they, you know, it's you know, firewall stuff, CVEs, IPS, IDS. Obviously, this does not cover enough for people. I think we try to do the best we can. and then you should ask them directly those types of questions. Now, you know, a lot of them will tell you we're working on it, we're trying to get it coming. I think that this situation also, there's a little bit of market value here. On the other side is that as these V6 only things are going to happen, if those guys don't figure it out real soon, they're going to have problems, mm-hmm. right? They're going to get hurt in the market. And I think we're really close to that being a tipping point.
There's like legacy, you know, testing organizations that have tested firewalls in the past and they haven't even really thought about IPv6, or their IPv6 testing of their products are optional. And so you could, as a vendor or as an enterprise, buy a product that's been vetted by this other lab that's known for testing firewalls. You buy it because, oh, it's been vetted. This company tests firewalls. They say it's a great firewall. But then you end up with a product that doesn't do IPv6, and that's on your critical path for IPv6 deployment at your internet edge and to bring it further in. Now you just bought a product that isn't going to age out of your network for 3-4 years, and it's a V4 only product. So that's a danger.
Right. We have the same, you know, I've heard the same thing where, you know, I test an IPv6 stack and I'm like, the stack works great, but they don't use it. Don't turn it on. Those kind of stories make me sad when those kind of things happen, right? Because that's kind of what we try to do the best we can. And this is, you know, on everybody to try to make sure that when we say, hey, you know, when you're doing that testing, you know, please make sure that you test the V6 stuff at the same time. Not that it has to be the full testing that we do, right? Because we go pretty in depth on those standards. I think there's some basic tests that you can run to sort of get you making sure that things are running. But I also have the reverse of that too. And this is the stuff that we're trying to explain to people. It's like, look, don't just test the stack, use it. Use it for your stuff that you're going to do. You'll find it helpful. But yeah, it's, you know, it's unfortunate that those kind of things happen. I think some of that is just natural and that, you know, those labs or whoever it is focused on the security issue, not on the stuff underneath, and kind of this is where we're trying to make those two meet as best we can.
Yeah. Many, many years ago, we saw a lot more vulnerabilities around crafted packet vulnerabilities around IPv6 because IPv6 devices, those stacks were new and there were edge cases that an attacker could exploit to cause a failure, a DOS attack, or even at worst, a privilege escalation. So now products have gotten better. But also the testing tools have gotten better too. So haven't the testing tools getting better? Has that helped you?
Yeah. I mean, well, in some cases, right, obviously a lot of the stuff we do, this is the advantage of having all of these undergraduate students with degrees in computer science. We create a lot of our own tools. So we don't experience some of the problems in that we obviously have a deep knowledge in V6. When it gets, as it goes up, you know, into more complicated things, we absolutely have seen better tools for what's available in the V6 space now. You know, what's funny is we're kind of dealing right now with a slight overcorrection. So all those crafted V6 packets, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone went when those were coming out and built their firewalls to, you know, only forward, you know, very pristine packets, in particular ones that don't have a whole lot of extension headers. Mm-hmm. And that's led to a different problem that we're trying to undo now, that people want to put cool things in extension headers, but extension headers die at the border. And so things like segment routing. Has some really interesting properties to it. You know, there's this trying to figure out how we make, you know, extension headers were really an important part of V6 and I think can be useful. And it sounds like the hardware guys on their side, I mean, we could argue what's hardware now, but it sounds like that they can figure out how to do extension headers to a point, you know, how many are in there and process them in a quick manner that's not going to impact it. But then we have this problem of all, you know, for a while there, they were told to drop anything that they didn't recognize. And we're trying to correct it back to what should be right, where, okay, there's malformed packets and then there's packets, you know, that are properly formed that we should be letting through because they have. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about the security part, but just that they shot everything at the door was a real problem.
Right. Yeah, you can blame me. I was one of those people who was pretty excited about routing header zero and maybe caused people to turn it off.
Right. And
routing headers.
Right. And when they turned them all off, right, there was a whole different set of, and what's funny is now they're really trying to reuse the routing header, which is, you know, the interesting one. There's some routing header ones, there's some destination ones. The really bad one we've had to deal with obviously is fragmentation. The fragmentation header going away basically has made it so that everyone who's on the internet has to send V6 packets of less than 1280. Because if they send it bigger than that, there's a pretty good chance it won't make it. Because the minute that there's a fragment, it's toast.
Right.
So that's one of the, those are the kind of things where, you know, operational guidance that we're trying to give to operators running networks and firewalls that, you know, don't be scared of those extension headers. I think at the time, like you said, routing header zero is bad. I think, you know, that might've been the solution now. Now we're just trying, it was just a slight overcorrection. We're just trying to bring people back. Like, you know, that there's a slightly better way. You need to think about this. You shouldn't shoot them all at the door.
Right. A little more nuanced is what's required. Cause there is some interesting use cases. Scott and I both sat in a session. Was it 2 years ago at Cisco Live with Frank Brockners on in-band OEM, right?
Yes. For
that was really fascinating seeing what he was doing there in terms of those capabilities for NFV.
Yeah, and they're doing a lot of interesting stuff in that space. So hopefully we'll continue to see V6 innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, you know, unlike V6, which, you know, is infinite. It, for all practical purposes, right?
Yes.
We sort of run out of space on the podcast side. We're running a little long. So, Tim, I wanted to find out, you know, for the audience, books, blogs, public appearances, Twitter handles. What would you like to share with
stuff we have is I'm going to point you at the IOL site. Go see it. You can see all the great work our students are doing. Those of you who want to hire students, there's a link on the side for resumes that our students post. If you're looking for that kind of stuff, it's all in there. It's at UNHIOL is the Twitter handle. And we also have a Facebook page, but you can just go to the website. If you look up iol.unh.edu, that will get you to our website. We also list all of the devices we've tested for U.S. government that have complied. They're all listed there. You can go see any of that information.
Tom, contact and info for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on Twitter at IPv6Tom, and also the author of IPv6 Address Planning on O'Reilly Press, which you can find on Amazon. And publish on the InfoBlox Center of Excellence blog for their community site.
Cool. Scott?
I also contribute to the InfoBlox IPv6 Center of Excellence blog. I tweet at Scott Hoag, pretty basic. And then author of the Cisco Press book titled IPv6 Security.
Cool. And I'm Ed Horley, just E. Horley on Twitter. You can follow me there and see all the crazy antics of what I'm up to or what particular conference I'm at. Because I just got back from another one. But with all of that, hey, really appreciate folks listening. And we will see you on the internet. More importantly, we'll see you on the IPv6 internet.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.